Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Israel Studies. I'm Yaakov Yadgar, the host of the channel. Today, we will be talking to Professor David Jacobson about his new book, The Charm of Wise Hesitancy, Talmudic Stories in Contemporary Israeli Culture. Jacobson, a professor of Judaic Studies at Brown University, offers in this book an overview and detailed analysis of one of the most intriguing cultural phenomena in contemporary Israel. Return to the supposedly religious Jewish bookshelf. It's a return that happens by both self-proclaimed secularist Israelis and Orthodox Jews. Specifically, Jacobson is interested in Israeli readings of Talmudic narratives and the way these readings reflect upon contemporary Jewish-Israeli identity. His book situates the phenomena in its socio-historical context and offers a detailed analysis of the discourse on certain Talmudic narratives. Professor Jacobson, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I wonder if you could begin by telling us a bit about the background for writing the book. Can you maybe please describe how you came to study the phenomena of New Israeli Talmudic readings?
Well, I would say, first of all, that most of my research throughout my career has been on the relationship between modern Jewish culture and the Jewish tradition, particularly as explored by Hebrew writers. Initially, I worked on Hebrew writers in Eastern Europe, and then over time, this became a more central phenomenon among Israeli writers, and that eventually became my focus. My first book was on the relationship of the modern Hebrew writers of the late 19th and early 20th century to traditional texts and how they retold biblical narratives, rabbinic legends, and Hasidic tales. And they did this in an attempt to connect those texts to their contemporary concerns. Over time, in subsequent books, I wrote on biblical imagery and religious themes in contemporary Israeli poetry. And the book before this current book I focused on a group of religious Zionist West Bank settlers who adopted the forms of so-called secular Israeli poetry to write about their religious concerns. This book is really a continuation of this, my longstanding interest in the relationship between modernity and tradition, but it took me in a new direction. Rather than write about works of belletra, fiction, poetry that adapts and retells a biblical stories and other religious narratives, I turn to the study of how contemporary Israelis read these Talmudic stories that you referred to. And I got the idea for the book beginning in the early 2000s. I was browsing in Israeli bookstores, and I noticed that there were a number of anthologies coming out at the beginning of the 2000s, anthologies of Talmudic legends, which presented contemporary interpretations of those legends. And I began to say to myself, I think there's a trend here. And so I began to look into it, and that's what eventually the result was, this book.
Yes. So maybe you can describe this trend or the phenomenon in some details for those who are not familiar with it.
Okay, well, as you mentioned in your introduction, this comes out of the cultural phenomenon of Hazara la'aron ha'sparim ha'yudi, the return to the Jewish bookshelf, as it's called. And this phenomenon was largely a very, as you say, significant phenomenon in Israeli culture, in which secular Israelis began to question the fact that in their education, there had been a kind of repression or marginalization of post-biblical texts. Israeli secular Zionist culture looked to the Bible as essentially the source for values, the source for religious vision, or I would say cultural vision. And they began to question that. They began to say to themselves, this focus on the Bible doesn't work for us. It works better in a time of more, what might say, Zionist triumphalism, a sense of the return to the land, the assumption of power. And they were living in a very different time, a time in which Israel had gone through tremendous amount of ongoing struggle. that the Zionist dream was turned out to be not fulfilled immediately with 1948, that there were many issues and even a sense of vulnerability that came to be felt. And so they were looking for other sources that spoke to them, and they in a sense rediscovered rabbinic texts. And one genre that became particularly attractive to them were these Talmudic stories. It started, really interestingly enough, the return to the Jewish bookstores, initially in the kibbutz sector, the kibbutz movement in the 1960s. Over time, it began to spread beyond the kibbutzim. It became institutionalized in what are still known as alternative batei midrash, alternative study houses, where secular Israeli Jews would come and study post-biblical texts. And it's really out of this phenomenon that these anthologies and also articles that interpret Talmudic stories emerged.
Yes. So I think it became a trend, if I'm not mistaken, myself, by analyzing a scene I've been probably part of. It became a trend after the assassination of Rabin and what was called then the soul searching that overtook Jewish Israeli society at large. But you rightfully make the point in your book that this didn't start in the 1990s. This has a longer history, in a sense, of the disenchantment with secularism, in a sense.
Yes, this is disenchantment with secular Zionist ideology and with secularism, in a sense that something was missing. Something was missing. And the previous generations, the ones, the parents, the grandparents of the people who went in this new direction, had their own reasons for rejecting rabbinic culture. And it largely had to do with the fact that they associated rabbinic culture, rabbinic text, with all that they saw as being problematic in the diaspora. And they saw it really as a barrier to the Zionist revolution, cultural revolution that they were trying to develop. Now, as typically happens is revolutionaries have their ideology, but then the next generation comes along and says, but wait a minute, we don't feel the need to reject these texts. We're not fighting against them. They're not the texts of our youth that we think are repressing us. We actually are finding a lot that's interesting, and that gives us a whole nother dimension of understanding of what it means to be Jewish and what it means to be Israeli that was sort of taken away from us. Some will talk about the fact, why was this hidden from us? And there's a kind of a rebellion of the return of the repressed, as you might say.
Yes. And interestingly, this is still done under the guise of secularism. Many of the leaders of the movement would reject any accusation, quote unquote, that what they're doing is actually an act of religionization or return to religion or even a religious reading of the text.
This became a really big issue in the going back to the kibbutz setting, the secular kibbutz setting, when certain figures in the kibbutz movement started to Avraham Shapira was one of the main, for instance, one of the main leaders of this phenomenon, started to introduce the study of post-biblical text. Some people were really horrified. They said, "What are you trying to do? You're trying to make us chozrim b'tshuva? You're trying to get us to go back and be fully observant Orthodox Jews?" And people felt very threatened by it. And over time, people began to realize that one can study these texts on their own as works of literature, as works that explore a whole variety of very interesting issues that are relevant today as they were when they were written. And that doesn't necessarily mean that one is going to adopt the halakha as a lifestyle. And I think over time, more and more secular Israelis began to realize that this wasn't a threat to their essentially secular identity. But what's also interesting is that as this developed over time, one can begin to see a phenomenon of some of the secular Israelis studying these texts who said, but you know, maybe we should try to explore certain aspects of religious life, not just study the text. And so you had the formation of prayer communities by so-called secular Jews who said, we want to pray. And that became very problematic, of course, because if you don't believe in God, or if you're an agnostic, how do you pray? And all sorts of issues, but they did it anyway. And some of these communities then began to observe Shabbat together, and began holidays together, and life cycles together. So it's an interesting way in which they had to find their own way beyond just the study of the text to actually creating new kinds of communities that are by so-called secular Jews who are rediscovering the wealth of experience one can get out of the Jewish tradition.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to note, I remember reading once a critique by, I can't recall the name, a very fierce critic of the movement, of the return to the Jewish bookshelf, who argued that the very immersion of oneself in the Jewish text would amount to to one's becoming Jewish or becoming religious, I'm sorry. For this critic, the very opening of the book was already an act of succumbing to religious power, which is the context against which it happens.
Yeah, I write in the book about what has now in Israeli circles become a well-known speech by Ruth Calderon, who at the time, she was one of the leaders of this return to the Jewish bookshelf. And for a brief period of time, she was a member of Knesset. In her introductory talk, she actually taught from the dais of the Knesset, she taught a Talmudic story. And there were secular Israelis who were really horrified by this, because they said, look what's happening. Here we have a fellow secular Israeli trying to push us over to the side of the Orthodox who impose religion on us, the Orthodox who are anti-democratic. And her message, and the message of those who I write about in the book, is that this is literature that can actually be studied outside the context of a particular commitment to a particular set of observances or even belief system.
Yes. I recall that... speaking of Ruth Calderon's speech, it has become a cultural phenomenon among Jews outside of Israel. And this brings me actually to the second topic I wanted to talk to you about, which is actually the distinguished Israeli characteristics of these readings. What would you say distinguishes those readings that you review in your book from other engagements with Talmudic text, both in Israel and outside of it?
Well, first of all, this gives me an opportunity to mention another dimension that actually surprised me. When I went into studying this material, I assumed that it would be about this return to the Jewish bookshelf by secular Israelis who had not been educated in post-biblical culture and who were rediscovering it. Along the way, I discovered that there is a parallel phenomenon among religious Zionist Israelis. So those who might return to America, we might refer to them as modern Orthodox in orientation. And it turns out that while the secular Israelis experienced the repression of rabbinic texts because it was threatening to their parents' ideology, their grandparents' ideology, these religious Zionists certainly didn't experience the repression of religious texts. But what was repressed were actually the legends in the Talmud. And there was a longstanding tradition among, particularly in Eastern European yeshivot, that became the basis for the Israeli religious Zionist study of Torah, to when they would read the Talmud, they would skip over the legendary material that's actually embedded with the legal material. And they would skip over it and say, well, it's not important. We have to look at the legal text and not the rabbinic and not the legendary text. And around the same time, and I think to some extent under the influence of the secular interest in Talmudic stories, religious Zionists in certain yeshivot began to say, let's actually study these. These really have a lot to offer us, as well as the legendary material. Now, of course, this is very what goes on, whether it's written by a religious Zionist writer or a secular writer. This type of reading is very different from the traditional reading. So it's important to distinguish it. There's, of course, a longstanding tradition of traditional commentaries, whether it's the commentaries on the Talmud, Rashi, the medieval scholar, and then later his followers, the Tosafot, many different commentaries specifically on rabbinic legends, but they're all within a context of Orthodox Judaism. They're largely a diaspora context, and they have a very different flavor from what these texts are doing, because what these texts are doing is they are, of course, reflect two revolutions in Jewish culture. One is the Zionist Revolution and the emergence of Israeli sovereignty within Israel. The other, of course, is the modern questioning of religion and the crisis of faith that comes with modernity. That's their starting point. And the whole quality, the whole way that they approach it is very different from that of the traditional commentaries. Now, if you want to ask about outside, people do often ask me, is there a similar phenomenon in America, which of course is the other primary or large Jewish population, and I would say no, not really. That's not to say that there aren't people here who study rabbinic legends and who find it interesting and who are attracted to it, both secular American Jews and Orthodox and other types of religious Jews in America. It's just has not taken on the same kind of cultural force that it has within Israel, and it's because all the reasons why people turn to it, particularly the secular Israelis turn to it, it's really that kind of context doesn't exist in America. So it's really I don't see the same thing going on. There's some interest. Some of the material has been translated, and which is very good, and people begin to read it. But one can't really compare what's going on in Israel with what's going on in America.
So, other than being mostly happening in Israel, what's uniquely Israeli about these readings in terms of content and framework of analysis?
I would say the analysis is on one hand, and what I think makes it accessible to people outside of Israel is, on one level, the extent to which these are modern, or one might say postmodern, readings of these texts, then that's an aspect that I think isn't necessarily uniquely Israeli. That's an aspect that Jews throughout the world can relate to. And it really comes down to the question of, are these texts relevant? Can we find anything in this text that is relevant, regardless of whether one observes anything or believes anything or whatever? And in that sense, they contribute both to the development of Jewish culture in Israel, and potentially it could to the development outside of Israel as well. These are such, one of the things that really attracted me to these stories is they are such well-crafted stories. As a literature person, I just began to so appreciate, they're in a minimalistic style. They somehow capture the essence of the issue that they're relating to. And they relate to issues that are common to, that anybody can recognize as relevant, whether it's power struggles, issues in marriage, relations between children and parents and children. All of this, these are these universal issues that anybody can relate to. But the other piece to it that particularly is Israel is the extent to which they provide alternative insights into issues related, whether it's political issues, social issues related to Israel. And I would say fundamentally the reason why that this has caught on among many secular Israelis is that I think they find in this a period of Jewish culture in which, if you think about it, it's written at a time when either the rabbis are living under Roman rule, they are politically vulnerable, they don't really have the sovereignty that Israel has. And then, of course, subsequently in Babylonia, where again they're in diaspora, don't have a sense of political sovereignty. But I think what it reflects is the sense that what's particularly interesting from a culture point of view is that Israelis, over time, with the ongoing frustrations of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and the recognition of the fact that Israel cannot only exist on its own without the help of anybody else. That conflict, of course, has made Israel dependent on other countries outside. That blurring of a distinction between what it means to live in diaspora, what it means to live in Zionism, and so the very sense of vulnerability that the rabbis had, the sense of confusion, the sense of who are we, what is our power, where is God, all these kinds of things actually really resonate very well in a post-Holocaust world, and also in an Israeli context where the power that Israelis have to control their fate is more limited than Zionism promised them.
Yes. However, I would say it would be, I mean, I think it's still interesting that it has not developed into a full-fledged alternative Jewish political philosophy. The readings are done under the guise of a cultural re-engaging with the text in a specific, as you say, political context, but they don't amount to a critique of Jewish sovereignty in Israel or the way it is understood.
Not a critique, but a recognition. I would say, it's true, it's not, it hasn't fueled any kind of political movement, but it's an admission that Israelis are more vulnerable than they are sometimes willing to admit to themselves. And a way of dealing with the helplessness that Israelis experience. And this whole, all the various, you know, the various traumas of the Six-Day War vulnerability before the final victory, or the vulnerability of the Yom Kippur War. And then, of course, the first intifada, the second intifada. So it's not a movement that fuels it's not something that fuels a political movement, but it's a set of texts that, from a political point of view, reflect the feeling of Israelis that sovereignty, ultimately, one's sovereignty is limited in this world, and at least it reinforces the sense that there's a reality out there that the so-called Zionist dream of, you know, to be a free people, to be a people in charge of your fate, it turns out it's much more complicated than Zionist ideology had said it would be.
Yet, for people looking from the outside in and expecting everything in Israeli politics to at least have some connection to the conflict, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as far as I can understand, these readings don't have much to offer in this regard, or they don't explicitly deal with the situation of an occupation or the presence of a large, a continuous security threat, as it is.
No, they don't. I don't think that they really lend themselves to a political critique. One sees this, I see this a little bit in some religious Zionist writers who have dealt with these texts. It's a small voice. It's not an influential voice, but I see that it kind of can support those again. It's as you well know, to the extent to which it exists, it's not influential. It's not politically influential, but there are some among the Zionist thinkers who are concerned ultimately with the moral dimension of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. They have almost no influence on their, you know, political, you know, socio-political context. But one sees here and there, one sees this sensitivity to a recognition of vulnerability and a recognition of, we are not going to be able to do everything we want, that there are other forces, including the fact that there's another nation here that is claiming the land. But I don't want to overstate that, because there's not really a movement. You know, there have been, within religious Zionism, there have been these sort of, you know, more, you know, left-leaning or dovish elements, but as we well know, they are largely, have been largely silenced mm-hmm. in recent years.
Yes. So let's expand a little bit the discussion on the socio-political context or backdrop of these readings. Regarding the group of students, of readers, would it be correct to identify this mostly as a middle-class Ashkenazi engagement with the text?
Yes, absolutely. It's an Ashkenazi phenomenon, and it is largely middle class, although there have been attempts to set up Batei Midrash in some of the development towns. And while I don't know the specifics of it, my sense is that in setting these up in the development towns, they're probably reaching somewhat, you know, less than middle class population, which of course dominates the development towns. but not being a sociologist, I don't know exactly how that's working out. But this definitely, as I said, it started with the kibbutzim, and then when it spread into the cities, into Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, it was middle class, it was Ashkenazic. It's really a product of the Ashkenazic, the trajectory of the Ashkenazic breakdown of relationship to tradition and then the attempt to recover it. I'm not enough of an expert in Mizrahi culture to be able to say why it didn't develop in Mizrahi culture, but I think all the various aspects that I've talked about already are very much part of the European Jewish experience and that of those who emigrated to Israel. But I think it's largely true. I think some Mizrahim have excelled in part. I think what's obvious to all observers of Israeli culture is that one of the ways that the return to tradition has expressed itself among Mizrahim is, of course, through music and through the revival of interest in piyut and in Mizrahi religious poetry, and it's a very different trajectory.
I think one could also make the argument that among Mizrahi Jews, there has not been such a break with tradition that would then be needed to an amendment by way of a return. But also there's the issue of one's ability to invest time and resources in this kind of study. This is a privilege of certain classes. Not everybody can.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And that explains why it is a largely middle-class middle-class phenomenon. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned in the opening of your answers that the engagement with the text was not necessarily meant to be tied to other realms of life. It was initially seen as only textual, and only gradually did it become something that is also touching about other realms of life, such as observance or, let's call it, ritualistic manifestation of one's Jewishness.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, I think that's very true.
What was so intimidating about the ritual in the first place?
I think it's, you know, what you had referred to earlier is a sense of we are secular, and as secular Israelis, we're the product of a need to rebel against the way of life, the Orthodox way of life in Europe, because that Orthodox way of life was in fact what kept us stuck in Europe, which didn't allow us to dream about the possibility of returning to Zion. After all, as is well known, the Orthodox rabbinic establishment in Europe completely opposed Zionism. They saw it as heretical. And so there's a longstanding sense of alienation from that tradition. And I think the other aspect, of course, is the hostility toward religious coercion, in the sense that secular Israelis have argued against the need to, against religious legislation that they see limit themselves. And so people kind of came into it with a sense of okay, I'll study the text, but I don't want to associate myself with that orthodoxy that is so culturally problematic and has much too much political power. What I think that these and other Ashkenazim had to discover was that it's not all or nothing. I think that's partly what the Mizrahi culture has not taken an all or nothing approach to it. There's a fluidity in terms of identity. One does kiddush on Friday night, but goes to a soccer game the next day. And there's a kind of an openness to many different ways of being loyal to tradition at the same time, living the kind of life you want to live. And once they've got over that kind of that sense of this is really, there's something really wrong with returning to traditional ritual observance, I think what they realized was there is something about prayer, there's something about religious observance that can actually be meaningful, whether you identify as Orthodox or not. And once they got over the hump of their prejudice, they started exploring it little by little. And I think that's what happened.
I think, in my understanding, something that lies behind the phenomena and the reactions to it is, a historical identity crisis, a Jewish identity crisis that has plagued the Zionist movement from its inception. The idea of being a national movement of the Jews yet rebelliously rejecting what Jews have traditionally seen as defining them as Jews.
Yeah, that, you know, to use that unfortunate metaphor of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, that's essentially what secular Zionism did. They had their reasons, and I understand their reasons for doing it. You know, when you are engaged in a cultural or political revolution, sometimes it initially takes on a kind of an all or nothing. You know, let's just tear it all down and rebuild it. So it does. Once the revolution is over, once people are back to living a life and they're not trying to engage, next generations are not engaged in any kind of revolution, they are freer to return to what their parents and grandparents had rejected. And it's not as much of an issue for them. And they discover what's really very enriching about engaging with this tradition. And so they're, you know, ultimately some kind of new Jewish identity is emerging within Israel. But of course, it's a very fractured identity because the groups are so, you know, so different. But this is one probably small, but I would say significant model of how one can recover, maintain some kind of an Israeli Jewish identity, but that also integrates into it the riches of the heritage of the religious heritage. Mm-hmm.
So, how do you assess the viability or the longevity of the phenomenon?
It's a good question. It's still going on. It's going on in more recent directions that don't seem to be actually abating any time in the future. So after the so-called alternative study houses emerged, the next institutional embodiment that I find to be really significant, and I think is going to have a long-term, and I'm really not talking specifically about the reading of Talmudic stories, that would be one piece of it, but the larger issue of this return to the Jewish bookshelf is the emergence of the so-called secular yeshiva. So the secular yeshiva is founded by the Bina movement in Jerusalem, in Tel Aviv, in Be'er Sheva, now continues this. And there is, I think, an ongoing engagement by people of secular background in this study and a sense that somehow we need something like this. I think it's going to keep going. I think it's going to continue because I think that at least certain segments of the population who come from a secular background are in effect saying, we need more than just to be a secular citizen of the Israeli state. We need more. And I think it is going to continue. It will be one of the ways that people relate to their Israeli Jewish identity that I think it's going to get passed on for a while. Yeah,
I think it's a fascinating chapter in the ongoing history of Israelis trying to grapple with the meaning of Israel being a Jewish state and with their own Jewishness. Well, Professor Jacobson, we've taken too much of your time. Can you tell us in closing what you are currently working on?
Well, it appears that I cannot free myself from my obsession with the question of the relationship between modernity and tradition. And this has characterized my entire scholarly work. And so I'm actually going to return to where I started. So where this actually started was, my interest in this topic was, in my dissertation, which was on the retelling of Hasidic tales by late 19th and early 20th century Hebrew writers in Eastern Europe, Peretz, Berdichevsky, and others. And I then incorporated my first book into a larger concern of modern Hebrew writers retelling traditional tales. The new trend that I've become very fascinated by and that continues, that I think is continuing to be a very important phenomenon within Israeli culture is the turn to Hasidism. This takes up many different forms, probably the most famous being now the fascination with Nachman of Bratslav. And that, by the way, is among Ashkenazic and Mizrahi Jews, which is interesting in itself. What I want to focus on, being a person who focuses on literature, I want to focus on the renewed interest in the Hasidic tales in contemporary Israeli culture. And so that I'm at the beginning of this point now, and I've identified two types, sets of writers who are turning to Hasidic tales to enrich their understanding of what their main concerns are. One is, interestingly enough, psychologists, particularly clinical psychologists, who look to Hasidic tales for insights related to therapy and the understanding of the human psyche. This is not surprising because Hasidism has had a preoccupation with the individual psyche. It's been very central to Hasidism. One of the things that distinguishes Hasidism from the earlier mystical movements. The other group are actually a number of religious Zionist thinkers, because as I mentioned before, these Eastern European yeshivot that are the basis for Torah study in Israel today, not only did they skip over the legends, but they weren't Hasidic. They weren't interested in Hasidism. It was a very much of an anti-Hasidic or non-Hasidic context. But the inheritors of that Torah tradition have, in a sense, kind of rediscovered Hasidism, the Hasidic tale, Hasidic teachings, as a way to enrich their religiosity. So that's where I'm going now. It's right at the beginning. It's an exciting time to kind of figure out what it's all about. And I spend time in Israel, of course, talking to people and reading back here. So hopefully it will come together as my next published work.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful project. I wish you all success with it. And I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
I really enjoyed it. Take care. And to you listeners, thank you for listening. And please make sure to check out other interviews in our newly established Israel Studies channel. Bye-bye.